Welcome to the Ether. Today is Sunday, July 17th, 2022. Today on the Ether, a CeFi space. Share your crypto alpha. Let's take a listen.
Hey guys, good afternoon. Oh, Scobie, how are you? Good to see you again. Just checking in, see what people are doing lately. If anyone wants to hop on here, hop right on. We'll kind of chit chat, bullshit for a little bit. Kind of want to hear what people are doing, what people are buying, what people are playing with. Hey, bud, what's going on? AGT, you're there?
Sorry. Can you hear me now?
Hey. Yeah, go ahead. What's up? What you been up to?
Yeah, not much. I pretty much focus on the Cosmo and Near protocol. On the September 12th, Sweatcoin, which is a Web2 app, kind of moved to earn. They've been around for years now. They actually attempted to go into crypto in 2015, but couldn't really find the venue. Either way, they're going to fully integrate September 12th with Near protocol, so all the Sweatcoins earned, they'll get equivalent to crypto, so it's going to bring a massive influx of new users into Near protocol. So,
what is the protocol? Describe
that. Sweatcoin. Have you heard of Sweatcoin? It's a movement to earn. It's been a Web2 app that's very popular in Europe and Asia. It's been around for years.
So Sweat, S-W-E-A-T.
Yeah, like sweat, like running, like sweat.
Oh, okay, yeah. Got it. Yeah, it's monitoring your physical activity or something.
Essentially,
like that?
Your steps, and for every 1,000 steps, you get this coin. And they've been around since 2015. They actually tried to integrate into crypto in 2015, but couldn't find the venue. They have over 60 million users. But come the 12th, they're going to be fully integrated into Near protocol. And then after a couple months, I think they're going to kind of go to other chains. So it might bring a lot of folks into the Near protocol.
Interesting. So have you been buying the Near coin in anticipation of this? Well, or are you kind of thinking that it's like it's going to have its own value somehow? Or what you're thinking?
Well, what I'm thinking is you bring a lot of, because right now the crypto space is too incestuous. You're going to be very chain specific. Essentially, during the bear market, we all become maxilists, maxis. We're not really checking other chains out. For me, I've always been kind of between Near, Cosmo, and AVAX. So it hasn't really been an issue, but I think what we need right now is an influx. So I think bringing people from Web2 into Web3 might bring a lot more people to start using Near protocol. On top of that, the IBC bridge is it's in the works right now for between Near and Cosmo. So that's going to be huge, along with Polkadot. So it might be something that the three chains may benefit mutually.
Yeah, I've been having a hard time figuring out, if chains that are not IBC compatible will make sense, going forward in the long run. Like what's happening here is very similar to, if you guys remember, like the DVD Blu-ray war or the, the VHS Betamax, kind of idea. You have these kind of standards that for interoperability that have to sort of win in the marketplace of ideas. And sometimes the winner ends up being a protocol that actually is technologically better. Sometimes that's not always the case. Like I think in the Betamax VHS war in videotapes, like Betamax won, but VHS won, but Betamax was sort of like the better tech, smaller tapes, better quality recording and like better analog compression or what have you. Anyway, like it depends. And then there's, of course, if you think about HDMI, HDMI is actually a tech that was built for a greater amount of security for the movie houses so that like you can't pirate videos as easily. That was the idea, is to make it a more friction process to pirate something. But HDMI is a really shitty protocol because, you know, if you have cables that are too long, or you have, you know, synchronization problems and errors, or you have to keep updating the damn thing for, you know, the latest, you know, video mode or what have you. Right. So I think that's sort of happening now with IBC, where like Near, Kadena, and a few others have talked about incorporating IBC. It makes sense to have an interoperability system. I'm not sure if there are any serious competitors to IBC from this angle. At least nothing that I have seen that's credibly likely. There's some interesting protocols like DAGs, like Constellation and IOTA and things like that, that are sort of interoperable in the sense that you can use any programming language and you just like connect to a database essentially, and can, you know, transact with different things. But you know, nothing's quite like IBC. Like we do have EVM compatible things like EVMOS, which sort of bridge the gap between Ethereum based, you know, Solidity stuff and then like Cosmos based things. But I'm interested to see like how it plays out with Near being a different tech.
Well, but you know that Near has Octopus, which is substrate based.
Right.
And actually, you know, Octopus is partially funded by the IBC Foundation. So, you know, really essentially Near and Cosmo have the underlying connection already.
Yeah. It's like interesting where you have like on the one hand, a chain that has its technical merits with sharding and whatnot, and then it uses IBC so it can intercommunicate or communicate with Cosmos-based things. So yeah, getting that kind of speed and scalability. And there's a question of like, do you really need layer ones or should everything be an app-based chain? And
I think I asked one of the guys from Octopus, and the issue is composability. You may not be as composable if you use a dApp alone. At least that's what they explain. That's why they're just not focused on dApps or why you need EVMs.
Right. Or for that matter, like if your particular app chain, there's IBC components of composability, but then there's other programmable elements that might not be composable. Yeah, you're right. So it's up to layer one to sort of create the standards so that you can connect your, you know, if you get a Samsung Blu-ray player and you get a Sony Blu-ray player, the disc will work in both, right? Like, so the composability part is part of the interoperability, but they're not one and the same, like you said. There are some nuances there. But like, do you see, like, what do you see on Near that you think is going to, like, do you see a huge number of protocols coming to Near that are going to take advantage of their composability?
I believe so. I mean, I think, you know, because Near has Aurora too, which is interesting. Aurora is EVM, but it's a smart contract on Near. Also, you know, Near has a Ethereum-like client. So essentially, Ethereum is an L2 to Near. But yeah, as far as DeFi, both Aurora and there, you know, there are a lot of perpetual books, ordering books. So I think at some point they're all going to be interconnected, but I think you hit the nail on the head. It's the best time to win is going to be adoption. And right now, people are not just going cross-chain or exploring as much. So that's one of the concerns. But hopefully, come next bull run, we'll start exploring more and playing with other chains.
Yeah, I think the vast majority of people that are outside of the tech space, they're going to get really confused by what chain is what. You know, they don't really care, right? Like if they can get an end product to work and they don't have to know what chain they're on, that's how you know you've won, basically. Like, you don't have the average person on like their iOS, right? Like, nobody freaking knows, you know, that they're on the Swift based app or whether they're on some other, you know, Xcode based app that, you know, that's Apple related. So people don't really want to know what the underlying operating system or chain is, really. They just want to know what it can do for them. And like, if you even look at Google, Apple at this point, like if you're talking about smartphones, like, you know, even there, most of the features have reached parity for the most part. And I think with blockchain based apps, a lot of them will reach feature parity to a large extent where everyone copies each other. You know, everything's fairly quick. And if you have enough things, you're parallel scalable. Because, you know, each, when you have each app specific chain, you know, the number of users is a subset of the total users, and you can scale that way. So, you know, I think scalability is solved by massive parallelization, essentially. And ultimately, like you said, it's going to be about who creates a product that people want to use. And that's the hard part, I think.
100% agree. Thanks.
Yeah, no, thanks for the info. With Near, do you personally maintain a substantial portion of your portfolio in the coin, or what are you doing with it?
Yeah, man, I'm like pretty much 60% Near, 30% Cosmo, and 10% AVAX. Actually, I haven't been picking up too much Bitcoin or Ethereum, but I'm gonna have to change that tune. Near's coming up with a lot of projects, and you know, right now they have so much incentives at DeFi. And they come up with leverage farming, and not a lot of people are using it. So I'm just racking up the rewards, man. Like the APYs, yeah. And, you know, the USN, you know, they just changed the USDT backing. And the farming for USDT, USN is like 13%, 15%. So, yeah.
You know, I've had an interesting, I don't know if it's a change of heart or what, but to some extent, I think I've gotten more interested in coins that sort of don't really do anything. Like, for example, Bitcoin, right? Like, there's no special programmability. It doesn't really do anything except, you know, peer-to-peer transactions. You know, its network is secure, and, you know, people buy and sell it, and, you know, it's worth what it's worth. I kind of like this idea. I'm liking more and more like the base Atom token of Cosmos. It's the idea that, like, you a lot of exchanges have the token. You can buy Atom almost anywhere. You can bring it into the Cosmos. You can buy and sell shit in Cosmos. You can convert it to Atom on the fly. You can send it back to an exchange if you want, and you can sell it for fiat, right? This sort of fiat on-ramp, off-ramp gateway effect that creates is really cool. Because if you think about it, like, let's say you have 300 different coins on Cosmos in the next 5 years. I think we're getting close to probably 50 to 100 now. A bunch of different projects, bunch of different app-specific chains, right? It's going to be harder and harder for each of those apps to, like, vie for space on centralized exchanges, for one. So getting sufficient liquidity into those coins is going to become, I think, harder as time goes on. Like, if you look at what Coinbase did over the last, I don't know, year, they started listing all sorts of random shit coins, right? Like completely useless coins to some extent or the other. And they, like, pump when Coinbase lists them, but then they kind of crash. That's a different issue. But I think going forward, the centralized exchanges are going to have a hard time figuring out what to list that's going to make them money, right? The app-specific chains, you could build essentially infinite numbers of them. And there's all the work of listing all those coins on, say, Coinbase or a Gemini or whatever. And if you're only going to have like 10 customers for that coin you listed, the amount of work it takes to list the coin may exceed the amount of money you're going to make actually on the coin itself through trading. So the DeFi experience, I think, is going to create a situation where you're going to have some coins that you use to enter an ecosystem, whether that's a USDC, a Tether, whether it's like an Atom or an Ethereum, a Near, and you're going to get into that layer one chain, and most of the volume on centralized exchange is going to wind up being the layer one coins, and then you're going to take those things and you're going to spend them however you want in your ecosystems. It seems like that's the next step. Eventually, I think what will happen is you will be able to buy whatever the hell you want, and you will seamlessly transact where you won't even notice that you bridged across your layer one chain. So, you know, maybe a company like a Coinbase could offer dramatically higher numbers of coins, but the difference is you don't realize that you're actually swapping from one coin to the other in the process of getting to this, right? You see this in some of the apps like X Wallet and some other ones where basically you're hopping from chain to chain, and you're swapping from an Ethereum to, let's say, Atom, but it's jumping through several different DEXs and what have you. This type of thing where wallets kind of like drive this, I think will be pretty typical. But I think what will happen is for people to be able to build build out substantial infrastructure, they need to know that their base layer chain coin is not going to falter, right? Like what happened to Luna on Terra, the problem was that the coin was tied to the mechanism of the UST peg. Everyone here obviously realizes this. And when that died, the chain essentially went to shit because, like, you know, the coin doesn't function the way it's supposed to on the validators and all that, right? So what happened to that chain is the whole system got wrecked. If you look at Atom, you know, some of the people that have been in Cosmos from the beginning, like Jaquan and others, some of the folks are adamantly, like, just completely opposed to the idea of messing with the base chain. Leaving it as a purely simple liquidity layer that doesn't do a damn thing, that has, you know, quick transaction times. You're not meant to really be making any money on the thing. Like, in other words, whether Atom goes up or down is not the thing. It's whether or not it, you know, the flow of cash flow through this gets validators paid. It's fairly inflationary in Atom's case. But like what I've been doing with Atom is like when the price of Atom drops severely, I just grab some and then I take my yield from the Atom, which is like, I think now like 19%. And I think it goes up because the less people are staking, the higher yield like climbs. So it incentivizes newcomers by paying you out in the inflationary rewards. And what that means is like anyone who's not staking it is basically losing money because you're basically being subject to inflation. And anyone who's staking it is at least treading water and standing still, right? That's the idea behind it. You own like a greater fraction of the total like coins outstanding by holding on to them. So that's kind of interesting to me. I've been kind of watching that and I've pretty much like dumped a chunk of money into Atom. And, you know, I just pay my bills with it. Like whatever yield comes in from it, I'll like, you know, send it off to a Coinbase or whatever and sell it. And then I'll use my debit card on there and just pay for bills and this and that. So I think the idea is as long as a chain is unlikely to like blink out of existence and it's on, you know, with all of the different coins coming to Cosmos and all the projects, that indirectly creates strength from Atom, even though you don't really use the Atom for anything in particular, right? You would think that like that's a bad thing, but I'm not so sure that it is. Like, I think if it's basically immutable, if the network remains secure, it becomes maybe over time increasingly decentralized. I think that's all you really need out of some of those basal, you know, chains. And then Sunny Agarwal posted today. I don't know if you.
Yeah, about the next step. It's not going to be that once, but it's going to be the projects. But it's interesting though. The VCs have first dibs on these apps. Yeah. They're the ones who benefited initially from these projects and apps that come on layers, you know?
Yeah. No, there's no doubt. Like the problem with so app chains are cool because, you know, ultimately the apps are what are probably going to make money if something makes money at all. There's not enough money just in transaction fees alone to sort of run these systems. There aren't going to be endless numbers of users to like just sort of support the Ponzi kind of a thing. So in order to ultimately make money, there has to be apps that do something, and they have to do something that consumers want, like that, you know, you find that it's a killer app. It has a use case that you just can't live without. And you're going to start using these things. And his point is like, okay, like, you know, whoever Disney World or something decides to run their system on, you know, a Cosmos chain or something like that. Right. And now they're able to make money by making their system work smoother on blockchain, whether it's like a rewards program or any other like commercial enterprise, then eventually like some value will be extracted from that system and they'll make some money. And whether that's, like you said, whether that actually means that you're going to make money as an investor or whether seed round capitalists, you know, or venture capital and others are going to make all the money off of it, that remains to be seen, right? Like that's the thing, even in the stock market, though, this has become an issue where it's become like harder and harder to be quote unquote early, right? Like whether it's app specific chains, whether it's the stock market, what has happened is that a lot of projects, companies, they've discovered that, hell, it's easier to like it is easier to get capital through those routes than it is to try to go to provide the early investor with a lot of substantial benefits. So like even in the stock market, like you could basically buy a stock and it's already done 100x essentially from what the people that started put their initial capital have made. So it's not a shocker at that point that Coinbase's stock dumps from, you know, whatever its IPO price is, 250 plus or whatever, and it dumps down to $50, right? Like this was pretty much like, so this is a problem for retail investors and stocks in general. And I don't know what that means for long-term investing, either in crypto or in stocks, honestly. But I do think Sunny's like point is that, you know, app-specific chains, they're gonna keep leeching away possible users from whether it's L1s or other systems. And I think that's, you know, imagine right now you have like 50 Cosmos chains. Imagine there's 500 of them, right? Go to your iPhone app store and you tell me, like, how much money are the, so after you get past the top 500 apps in the app store, how much money are the top 600 to 10,000 making comparatively? It's way less, right? Like you end up having like in tech, some major winners and then lots and lots of like people that are treading water in terms of making money. So I don't know, we'll see how it goes, but this is why, like, the more I see app specific chains being built like DYDX and others on Cosmos, the more I go back to getting interested in the original vision of Adam. And I'm just curious how that plays out over the long run. Anyway, New, what's up? Or New C?
Hey, I just wanted to maybe offer quite a bit of deviation. So I just wanted to take a quick moment to connect the dots for you guys. But, you know, I was super serious about Luna. And then I was also got into the VGX, especially the VGX Hero community. But with all the DeFi stuff, going wrong, for some reason, you know, controllable or uncontrollable. What's interesting is that I went back to my childhood days and tried to get an escape, and I started getting back into like collectibles, especially digital comic collectibles. And that led me to the collectible community, which led me to the art community, which led me to the NFT community. And now I'm looking at potentially creating NFTs with this AI program. So AI NFTs, and I switch couple levels from being serious about DeFi to being more on the artistic content creator side with the help of AI. So I just wanted to bring a weird angle to where it ended up for me, but I'm sorry, I'm leaving more moving more away of the DeFi space and looking at that AI generated And the metaverse is another interesting angle for where the NFTs can find more interesting utilities. It's not the NFT, yeah. the smart contract is definitely different than the JPEGs that they may have been known for in the past. So
yeah, no, of course. Like the NFTs, essentially the idea of, you know, an immutable data point, essentially. And you know, any number of possible applications can happen when you have a piece of information that doesn't disappear. Data persistence essentially is what this all wraps up to be. You know, I've had some struggles with that a little bit, and part of my questions come in. Okay, like let's say you're into an NFT community, whether it's on Ethereum or otherwise, right? What is the guarantee that that chain will exist, let's say, I don't know, 100 years from now, right? So if you buy a painting from Picasso as an example of like a store of value with art, there are people that invest in art purely for the purposes of maintaining their value over time and perhaps growing their value over time. And, you know, with the Picasso, you have to do a lot of things. You have to store it. You have to maintain a certain temperature. You've got to do a lot of things to make it persist over the next, let's say, 500 years, right? There's no guarantee it will exist in 500 years. That's part of the allure, in a sense. And there's a lot that has to go to securing this information over time, right? Persistence of data, essentially what it boils down to. If you look at what happened, say, for example, to NFTs on Terra, the chain still exists, the Luna Classic chain. You have NFTs that were produced on that chain. But the problem is that those same users who owned it and who are selling those NFTs have a problem with not so much the persistence of the JPEG and the existence of the NFT contract, but there's no guarantee that, say, for example, the validators in that chain will persist over the next, well, I don't know, 20 years, 30 years. So even if, for example, some of the NFTs on Terra Classic end up becoming sort of like legendary in the sense that these were objects or data points that were created, and they have now a story, right? The crash of Terra is sort of a story. So maybe, like, you know, a lot of times a tragedy art increases in value in a sense. But the problem with NFTs that I still face is the immutability of the chains and whether that's sufficiently guaranteed to make sure that the value proposition of NFTs actually, like, you know, 50 years from now, 100 years from now, the thing still exists and you can lay claim to this this piece of information. So that kind of still worries me. I think right now the only credibly battle-tested chain from a perspective of both decentralization and persistence is probably Ethereum. Could that be broken with Ethereum 2.0 if some fiasco happens? I don't know. Right? Like, that's a possibility. But there's an app-specific NFT chain like Stargaze, which is doing a lot of interesting stuff. But, you know, the primary criticism of Stargaze is it's just not sufficiently decentralized yet. Anyway, I'm just kind of carrying on. But NFTs are super interesting. But I don't know, sort of like, not just for JPEGs and such, but in general, whether we've reached consensus on where we want persistence to live. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, that makes sense to me. And yeah, I appreciate that is an interesting angle, but the place where I'm at is actually not so much collecting NFTs now, although that was the stepping stones to where I'm at right now, but just the fact that I don't have artistic skills, but with the combination of there's AI art that's being generated and AI art NFTs. So if you take it from the perspective of a content creator, that persistent chain dependency may be mitigated because you're the generator of the art. You're the
The AI stuff is super interesting, and there's some beautiful work being done for sure in that space. Especially when it comes to, like, not so much the there's different layers of that, but yeah, there's a lot of cool stuff being done. Love some of the work that's coming out of there. AI generated music has some really interesting stuff happening too, which is exciting. Hey Marty, what's up, man? Been a while.
So I've kind of moved over to the validator and developer side, and I think and specifically now focused on NFTs. So the 721 standard probably takes care of, I don't know, 85, 90% of your concern, because that will make those standard NFTs be IBCable. So you'll be able to basically move them from chain to chain. Now, it doesn't necessarily deal with every advanced kind of capability that you might want to see out of an NFT at this moment, but it does deal with, you know, 100% of all NFTs, you know, 92%. But so I think that gets rid of a portion of your thing. That what you're talking about in general is so we have an app that we're about to release next week, I think. And this aspect of how NFTs seem very stuck, you know, inside of chains in terms of, you know, some level of observation, use, utility, whatever else. And that's been very curious to me as a phenomenon because, you know, I kind of came out of the internet stuff where everything was extreme. So we'll see if our little tiny baby step in this direction will stimulate a lot of people to think more about, you know, basically NFTs kind of across chains more. You can even see this even on the Cosmos space in that the Kepler wallet only supports Stargaze. I mean, you really can't get the other, you know, NFTs. And I think we've solved that problem, but we haven't really solved it in a, you know, a infinitely solvable way. We've just solved it across the kind of, we think we've solved it across the major players at the moment in time. Anyway.
Yeah, it's like there's still an element of there's still concerns to me about immutability. Part of the thing with IBC that you know, one of the battle tests that happened recently is when Terra crashed and you had cross-chain assets on Terra and, you know, things got wrecked and chains got halted. You had instances where people had IBC style assets that were stranded, right? So you wind up with these interesting problems that are slightly, so if you have one chain that's immutable, say like Ethereum, and you have an NFT data point stored there, you have one type of problem. On the other hand, if you have a problem with IBC with one of the chains and you just happen to have your piece of data stuck there, then you have a different problem. So then when you create an IBC system, what's weird about it is there's no centralized place for remittance. So let's say you have this data point and you want to lay claim to your NFT, but that chain, let's say, doesn't work for some reason, right? Like, and there's plenty of reasons why a lot of small chains could fail and your asset gets stuck there. I don't know if you had any comments about like how that gets solved exactly. Or is there a way for it to your data point to persist? Like, you know, if multiple chains that contain your data actually got halted or had a problem, would there be some way to like prove that that was your NFT if something happened? Right. I'm not sure that's been fully worked out yet, but we'll see.
No, I don't think that has been worked out, but there are chains that have like halted and then other people, not in the Cosmos spaces, but have halted and then other people came later and restarted them, okay? And, you know, you kind of wonder if, like, that's kind of one of the strategies that might be there. I think we're in this kind of, like, pre-Fed banking environment, right? Which is, like, if your bank fails and you weren't smart enough to move your cash, you know, out of, you know, First Iowa Bank to Second Des Moines Bank, then you lost your stuff. That's the situation that we're in. And we're basically used to, as an American culture, and maybe Western European cultures, to have this like very significant, you know, amount of fault tolerance that was not there historically and is not necessarily there on a worldwide basis. It's a really good objective, but, you know, we're probably not gonna fix that in the next 5 years.
Yeah, I was listening to Tone the other day. Tone Vase was on, and he was kind of talking about how, well, right now, the most credibly immutable system obviously continues to be Bitcoin. And his theory was, well, like, you know, you need to consider building NFTs on the Bitcoin network. I'm like, wait a minute, but that's not a smart contract network. And the moment you introduce a smart contract layer of any kind, that's not the same level of decentralization as the original network, right? It's not, you're basically creating like a layer two, which doesn't have all the properties of the original layer one, as far as not, either from a decentralization perspective or Byzantine fault tolerance or anything else. So, you know, that doesn't seem to work for me. Like, I think the Bitcoin network version for NFTs just hasn't been produced yet in my mind. And I like, even Ethereum doesn't fit that for me. So what I'd like to see is, so for example, if you have a piece of information and you believe it needs to live forever, like 5,000 years from now, you know, your profile pic or whatever the hell it is still exists, right? You are able to achieve persistence over time. It's a complicated problem in that it's very expensive. One is, if I take a picture of my dog or something and I, you know, create an NFT out of it, is there a good reason why the next 5,000 years of energy should be used to maintain the picture of my dog? Like, so one reason why information decays over time is because it's very energy intensive to maintain that information. It's true whether it's a Picasso, it's true whether it's, you know, data on the internet, which then has to have the continuous money of the internet to maintain that database, or whether a physical object. And some people, for archival purposes, have looked at like etching information in crystal, etching information, you know, in diamond, or, you know, other kind of physical objects to kind of have them persist. You've heard of people that write their seed phrase on, like, they'll carve it into a piece of metal, you know, so that they can like hide that away somewhere. Things like that, you know, so physical persistence. And even then, like, there are certain limits to how long that information can last, right? It could last, you know, let's say 100,000 years, but it may be beyond that. It's really difficult. And then there's other arguments about, like, should information persist that long? Maybe it's not particularly good for us. The longest information system in terms of duration that I'm aware of is, like, basically life itself. You know, DNA, you know, my DNA in my body has been passed down for 5 billion years of various molecular processes, but it's not immutable. The DNA changes, you know, there's mutations, there's, you know, sexual reproduction, and you have this mix and match of DNA, and you wind up with people with different hair color, skin color, whatever, right? So life has been doing this for a very long time, and it has a method to continue to evolve to make sure it can survive the physical world and transmit that information across, you know, literally billions of years. No system in the known universe beyond life has achieved this level of persistence that we know of. And so in other words, like, what NFTs, crypto is trying to do is just achieve what essentially life has already performed and has been doing so pretty well. But even then, with all that energy use it takes for you to have a child, for you to have your children to have children and pass on that data, tremendous amount of energy, by the way, it doesn't even do that with perfect fault tolerance. In fact, it's considered normal to have faults and transmit those faults. And sometimes those faults are considered beneficial. And, you know, that's how evolution works. You know, survival of the fittest means that sometimes some mutations that are not so great in some contexts are actually better in others. And then you wind up with this kind of process. I think what we don't have yet in blockchain or in NFT space or anything is we don't have this idea of evolution of chains in the same way. At least with Cosmos IBC, with the multiple application chains, we're getting to a similar situation where, say, for example, life has, you know, mammals and birds and, you know, fish and monkeys, you know, all these different life forms. App-specific chains are going to have the ability to, you know, like, specialize, use the energy resource to do specialized things. And that's how sort of life evolves. You know, my DNA and a whale's DNA and a plant DNA are very different, but they all, like, have different purposes in the ecosystem, use energy differently, and you know, are each individually able to survive in a different way. I think that type of decentralization is happening now with Cosmos, but at the same time, I'm still not sure. So, like, from an investor perspective, you think about, like, well, which one of these things should I buy? You know, for some kind of investment purpose, that's less clear. What's your take, Marty, on, like, the current state of Adam and kind of Jaquan's, you know, thinking that, you know, you want to have a base layer that's credibly immutable, that doesn't change very much, if at all, for the, like, rest of eternity? Like, what's your take on that? Like, do you agree with him? Do you disagree? Like, what do you think we should be looking for there? Or do you even know what I'm talking about?
I think I know what you're talking about. But before I answer that question and bring it up again, I want to go back to the metaphor of the bank, right? So if I take money out of my bank, which is FDIC, you know, insured, and it lives in the U.S., you know, civil system, blah, 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 blah. And I go to my neighbor because he asked to borrow $1,000 because his daughter is sick, and I loan him $1,000. I mean, there's a higher probability that I'm not going to get my $1,000 back, right? And maybe my favorite pizzeria, you know, they're having a real hard time, and you know, I loaned them $25,000 that I took out of the bank, right? And I even signed a promissory note, right? And here's $25,000. I get this piece of paper. It's a lot less probable that I'm going to. Can you shut the door? It's a lot less probable that I'm going to get that $25,000 back. You know, that's the equivalent of, you know, the contracts under the chains. If we think about the banks, right? I don't know if there's a Swiss bank in Bern or Zurich, okay, that's been in operation over 200 years. You know, the Bank of London has been, and that was in fact a private bank that goes back more than 200 years. So we don't really have too many institutions that are like banks that have lot, you know, have obviously had the lifespan of DNA. But an interesting opportunity there, which is it's possible that we could construct an NFT bank, right, where the contract that I have, you know, with that NFT bank is they're smart enough to move my 721 NFT, you know, to 10 different chains, like forever, right? It's like I put my NFT in the bank.
So you're saying basically like replicate the data so that it's recorded on lots of different places and therefore not reliant on the survival of one bank or one chain.
I'm not trying to use the word replication. Okay. I'm saying I put my 721 NFT into that bank. And like those banks in Bern, okay, is that if they think they're going to be overrun by the Romans or whatever, the Germans or pick your favorite people, they move it from Adam to Juno because Adam's going to fall apart. And they're smart enough to be able to move via heuristics and political analysis and back up, you know, agreements with validators that they will essentially guarantee you the NFT will all be available, always be available. What chain it's on, you know, may change from when you put it in versus when your granddaughter takes it out 120 years from now. That, I think, is a construct that can be created. Okay.
So you're saying really, like, I think you're saying what I used to say regarding how would you build like a decentralized stablecoin network? And that is that decentralized stablecoin would need decentralized remittance. Same thing with NFTs. Like you would have to have not just one chain, but many that would agree that you own your 721 or whatever piece of art or whatever it is you claim to own. And so it's not so much that it's replicating the NFT. There are just more places that confirm that you in fact have it than just one chain.
I mean, that's definitely a way to look at it. And I want to, but you went to stablecoin, and I think your statement of whatever last week about this, the other idea you hold in tension, you personally, I think, if I understand what you said, is the stablecoin only really needs to operate in its own, I don't even want to say chain, but I don't know what you call this thing, but in its own.
Like the Disney dollar idea, right?
Right. It's just like it exists in its zone. Or, you know, how the Chinese got money out of China to the United States, you know, at the end, the very end, was through Macau, you know, chips for gambling that they would fly them to Vegas, right? It's like there's something that's kind of locally within a group of casinos, you know, that maybe it's a bad metaphor here, but within a group of casinos that basically, you know,
it's the Disney dollar idea. It's like if I go to Disney World and basically I were to buy like $1,000 of Disney $50. So long as Disney World exists, I can go like ride on the Space Mountain and, you know, whatever. And like those points will be worth something for the next, you know, let's say 10 years, 20 years. Maybe they have an expiration date. Maybe they don't. Like it'd be very similar to gift card money, or very similar to like say you have a Walmart gift card and you have $200 in this gift card, and presumably it's as good as gold, because so long as that Visa network exists and the debit card network exists and Walmart exists, you know, that expiration date on that gift card is pretty reliable. Right.
Right.
That's a different thing than saying, hey, like 300 years from now, I hope that Walmart still exists so I can go buy, you know, croissants for $300.
Right. That's how I handle my Starbucks. You know, it's like, you know, when I run out of Starbucks dollars on my whatever, I put $100 in. Okay. And that might last me a year and a half, because I do my best to go find a local, you know, coffee shop, but I'm not really concerned, you know, that maybe
you're not worried that you're going to lose your Starbucks money
or $82 worth of it or whatever else. It's like, you know, it's not a big issue. So now let's go back to your question that you were posing there, which was, could you recapitulate that question? Sorry.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was asking kind of like this idea of what if you get back to sort of like this problem of governance and the problem of being able to break chains and, you know, creating situations where they're not immutable, where you could lose NFTs or you could lose your money or whatever. You know, Jay and others have said basically that, you know, their belief is that you need to have some base layer like L1 liquidity chains that are useful for nothing except their core function, which is like a store of value. And therefore, they're immutable. You can always transact in them. You can always compose on them. You can always, you know, and so you at least have some types. One of the functions, like a Bitcoin, which is immutability, you can rely upon that and you can bank, and you'll hope that that will at least be stable. And that way you can build upon that. So like, for example, an app-specific chain like Osmosis is a DEX, right? It has a DEX function. That's the primary function. It's a permission DEX. And if it holds Atom on the platform, we can be pretty sure that Atom is not going to be changed regardless of whether Osmosis lives or dies, right? Like the Atom is still functioning. It you can't break it that easily because it's not changed very much. It's kind of their theory is that some elements of these systems need to be immutable. Once you set it in motion, it should just stay in motion forever, and you shouldn't try to mess with it. That's kind of the idea, and I'm beginning to understand what Jay's been talking about all this time.
So,
and he's no idiot. He's an esoteric character, but he's no idiot for sure.
Right. So I take his point seriously, and I want to just add some caveats, which is, you know, that chain almost has to be apolitical, right? So. If you think about the Swiss franc, you know, one of my favorite previous, you know, things I'd like to hold, there was this, the Swiss franc was stable. The Swiss banks, the private ones were stable because Switzerland was neutral. You know what I mean?
And yeah, for sure. Yeah, exactly. So that's what Jay says about Cosmos is like, it shouldn't be political. You shouldn't have a bunch of votes on it and do a bunch of crap. You basically use it as a transmission layer and that's it.
Right. And the problem is that, you know, sometimes the people who are backing Cosmos or the Atom, whatever else, either kind of, you know, create political crises by doing something, or create crises by omission, right? The sin of commission or the sin of omission, right? And so nothing's like really, really perfect in that. So, you know, yes, we want the Atom, you know.
Well, I mean, if you look at DNA as an example, right? Like DNA basically gave up on perfection.
Right.
Right. That's literally what DNA is. You would not be alive today if there was a perfect version of life, and you know, you wouldn't have parents, you know, basically everyone would live forever and your DNA would just stay immutable. There's nothing specific about DNA that prevents it from being immutable, by the way. You can have really, really robust like DNA error correction systems And you can have systems that, you know, allow a life, an organism to persist a long time. Like, for example, some trees will live for thousands of years. You know, some turtles will live for hundreds of years. There's nothing specific about like lifespan that is not possible for DNA to do. But you'll notice the very most fastest evolving organisms are the ones that die the quickest, which is very interesting. Bacteria, viruses, right. things of right. that nature. So there's a trade-off between immutability and the evolution of things. And I think what you're saying is essentially that, like, so far we haven't identified blockchain perfection yet. Therefore, you're going to have politics because people are going to debate like the technical merits of one versus the other, and they're going to want to make changes.
Well, let's you use the word there, error correction, which is really good because that's like my information theory background, right? Like from way, way, way back ago. And so having, you know, the algorithmic support for error correction, first of all, it's like, you know, error, you know, detection and then error correction, right? We don't know, excuse me, necessarily, I think this would be a great debate and discussion, whatever else, what a blockchain needs for error correction. So take an example. So we have this model of validators. It's, in some sense, it's a form of error correction, right? It's like, is that really good? Is a multi-sig, is that another form of, you know, error correction? Is that really good? Is it, should it be five people or should it be 55 people? You know, so there's all that discussion of what really we need for error correction in this, and it's still evolving, you know. You know, again, being an internet OG back to 82, I can tell you that, you know, the changes in the internet technology, even in the first, you know, four layers, has been significant over, you know, 45 years. And that's a small amount of time, right?
Yeah, to the end user, a lot of those changes are essentially transparent, or you're seeing a lot of the indirect benefits of some of those changes, but a lot of people couldn't name them if they had had the gun to their head.
Until they don't work.
Of course, yeah. All of a sudden, everyone's a critic, right? When it doesn't work. So, yeah, of course. I think James wanted to hop on. James, what's up?
Oh, hey, great. Thank you for the space. I always appreciate these. I just wish I could figure out how to get on these when they start.
I sort of start them randomly when I have time, by the way, when I have like a mood for it. So it's not really, I didn't really pre-announce it. Sorry.
No problem. I'm just stoked that you're having it. So I've been an investor, I guess, in Cosmos Atom since January 2021. Sorry. And what I'm curious about is, what would you say, and I think you guys were kind of talking about this just now, but what would you say going forward would be its largest existential threat? In other words, what would come along, I guess, that would just supersede this and you know, perhaps make Cosmos wither eventually?
I think there's two parts to that. Like, one is there something to make the Cosmos SDK, the Tendermint SDK, you know, is there something that would simply make the tech obsolete in some form or fashion, right? That's one type of reason why you'd have an existential threat. The second would be, is there something that would break the function of the chain, you know, some sort of smart contract or upgrade that, you know, degrades the base function of the chain itself. Or let's say there's a political attack. Like, let's say there's some sort of system that doesn't actually break the chain, but pisses all the validators off. And they're like, hey, this is not, we're not making enough money doing this, so we're not going to validate this. Or maybe, you know, one of the criticisms of Cosmos in general tends to be, okay, there aren't that many validators, and there is a very strong tendency towards validator centralization because it's very hard organically for smaller validators to get sufficiently large enough, and therefore you have this voting power problem, right? So what if someone with a high voting power could create a consortium, or essentially a cartel of sorts, and then basically, you know, create some kind of systemic change that would wreck the chain on purpose for some reason? And now, you know, it may not be like probable that those kind of things will happen, but these are the kind of ideas that were brought up by Satoshi when, you know, it was decided that basically Bitcoin would not have any smart contracts on it, right? Like that was a very conscious decision. It wasn't like Satoshi was stupid and the reason why you don't have smart contracts on Bitcoin is because it wasn't possible. It was very much possible, right? So like that's a mistake to think that, hey, like Ethereum is just this big like technological innovation and like, you know, no one was ever going to figure out how to program, you know, on blockchains. That would be ridiculous. So the biggest issue here is, can any chain have this sort of existential crisis? And I think as soon as you introduce smart contracts, you automatically introduce certain layers and problems. The perfect, most textbook experiment gone bad at this point was Terra, right? Like, if you followed what happened there, the tokenomics of the coin was tied into the tokenomics of the UST DPEG mechanism or PEG mechanism. And when DPEG happened, you had wild numbers of, you know, Terra Luna printed, and that created a problem because, you know, the number of people that had voting coins could be outnumbered by those people who now could just buy massive numbers of coin on the open market. And basically, you know, they could vote for whatever they wanted to, even though they had to put in way less capital to achieve those votes. So those kind of problems. So for Adam, I don't know that there is a like distinct existential threat. The people that complain about, you know, Adam's lack of increased features, whether it's like the slow implementation of things like interchain security or interchain accounts, there's some neat things that people are talking about with it. The problem that some people have with Adam is that, hey, if we don't innovate, if we don't have more uses, then why would the coin retain value? And I think others say, well, it retains value because nobody's messing with the thing. And as long as people can rely upon it, then that may be all that's needed. The immutability portion may be all that's needed. And a whole lot of fancy functions may actually make it more fragile, not less so, right? Like, for example, great example would be human beings are not the most anti-fragile organism on this planet by any stretch. There are lots of creatures on this planet more likely to survive a meteor strike than we are. Right. So just because we have more complicated brains and more complicated DNA does not make human beings the most hardy organism on the planet from a permanence perspective. And I think that's what I've kind of been trying to get at. And life makes trade-offs for that. Right. So like if you have lots and lots of features for a chain, that doesn't necessarily make it more secure. And the odds are, in fact, it'll make it less secure. From a security perspective. Now, James, that answer your question. That's the Cosmos Adam like controversy to some extent in a nutshell, I think.
Yeah, no, that's great. I really appreciate that. And I was just trying to look up the minimum number of Cosmos that you need for to be a validator. How many is that?
Ooh, I'm not sure. Marty, do you have that number? I don't know.
Thought if I'd be able to pull it
away. Yeah, I don't know the exact number.
I think it's fairly high. One of the things, and I don't know if any of the DeFi or any coin has done this, but I wonder if there's a way to perhaps create a governance situation where, regardless of the number of coins one has, or that say annually, the voting rights could just be distributed randomly, and most importantly, it would just absolutely have nothing to do with what your holdings are, but you could democratize it in that way where.
Yeah, I've thought about this quite a bit. I don't know that there's a chain that specifically does that. But if you look at how just governments work normally, right? You have some people that say we shouldn't have in the United States an electoral college, right? You have people that say, well, you should just democratize all the votes and everyone just, you know, has the equal vote based on not where they live, but just, you know, it doesn't make any difference. There's, you know, let's say it's 400 million people. Everyone gets one vote regardless where you're from. And then other people argue, well, that's not going to be fair for certain states or certain regions and blah, blah, blah. Then you have the legislative branch of the United States that has a mixture of a Congress and a Senate. What's different there is the Congress has, you know, a certain number of representatives based on the size of the state, whereas the Senate is not size-based, it's equal for each state, right? So the founders of the United States figured out that, hey, you know what, there's no numerically perfect way to do this. Maybe if we diversify the types of votes that can happen, maybe we can mitigate too much centralization of voting. And I think that's sort of what you're asking. I thought to myself, hey, look, you know, if you're having legislation about complicated technical projects, like, I don't know, like genetic engineering or, you know, what is the long-term effect of having or not having abortion available in a country for the next 10,000 years, right? These are kind of like more, they're kind of scientific and medical kinds of questions sometimes. You don't really fully understand the ramifications of these things, either as a scientist or as a philosopher or as anybody really, right? But there is an underrepresentation of, say, for example, medical personnel in people making decisions or having discussions about these complicated medical topics, right? What if we had a system where you had to basically randomly get picked to vote? So in other words, you know, thousands of doctors will be sent out a vote. What do you think about this? And that vote actually has meaning and it's randomized so that you just have to volunteer. Or let's say, James, like there's a branch of government that actually was based on professions, almost like, you know, guilds, the days of guilds. And you actually filled that, you know, bank of politicians, not by the state that you're from, not by the you know, number of people in your state, whatever, but you'd actually fill it based on, you know, like a series of professionals, like, for example, engineers, doctors, people that work at restaurants, whatever, right? You have a series of professions and all of them got represented randomly and you just had to show up and serve, meaning you didn't actually get in because you're voted in. Like James gets called because he's going to be a representative because, well, that's your duty as a civic servant. Like it's very similar like getting called for jury duty, right? I think that's what you're trying to say. You know, is there an equivalent of a jury duty essentially for this? And I don't think anything like that exists yet. I know that DAO, D-A-O-D-A-O, is doing a lot of interesting governance-related programming on Juno. I don't know if something like this has been entertained by them in terms of like what you're talking about, which is, in other words, you get a vote that's equivalent to every other user of Atom, but you can't necessarily use your immense Atom riches to get more votes. The problem, James, has been is proving whose votes are whose, right? So let's say, for example, look what happened on Juno, where they did an airdrop and too many of the airdrop Juno went to a single user. Why did that happen? Because when they made this airdrop, they didn't realize that that user had, like, I don't remember how many, like, let's say tens of thousands of wallets, because they were a custodial wallet and they were holding lots of different customer funds, right? So now they have tons of wallets. Those users of those wallets didn't act vote because it's a custodial wallet, right? It's with a memo attached to it, sort of like a KuCoin wallet. And now all of a sudden you have an exchange or whatever that has a huge amount of voting power on the network. And it was an unintended consequence. And there's nothing preventing you, James, from having, let's say, 100 different Atom wallets and voting with each of them. You see the problem? So in blockchain, confirming that you, in fact, only have one vote because of your one wallet is basically impossible. That's the problem.
Got it. And so, I love your jury analogy, by the way. That's great.
I think people have been trying to solve this problem of governance for thousands of years. And I don't think there's anything special about blockchain that solves the math of governance problems in a sense, right? Like they still exist despite, you know, like, and you know, there'll be some people that'll say, hey, you know, like, hey, these politicians are just manipulating me. like, welcome to blockchain. I mean, like, go to any vote and you're like, wait a minute, I'm not sure, A, that I understand this vote. B, I'm not really sure this proposal is legit. Like, am I sure that this money is going to go where it's supposed to go? Who's going to enforce this thing? Like, what if I create a proposal on Cosmos that says that, like, okay, the mob needs to go and, like, imprison James. He's an asshole. Let's say the proposal passes and everyone's like, the mob is out to get James. And like, okay, fine. But like, who's going to enforce the actual, the jailing of James or whatever? Like, you know, you have to have an entire enforcement division to make sure the proposals are enacted as has stated, right? And even if a proposal, you know, did take place and, you know, it did get enacted, how do you know the code was as good as it's supposed to be, or, you know, is executed with high quality, or there was not a lot of waste and fraud involved? Welcome to government, right? That's the problem. So as soon as you rely upon other people to accomplish things, their version of efficiency might not be your version of efficiency, even though the proposal sounded pretty good, right? Like, so let's have a proposal to build 17 fighter planes, you know, for $1 billion, but actuality, it turned out to be, well, $17 billion, we went over budget. You know, it's hard to solve all that in a governance model. And I think that's the reason why I don't think that governance will be solved or whatever by blockchain. A lot of people have made the claim that DAOs, you know, are like a worse form of a corporation, you know, because like none of the people in the DAO are definitively accountable for anything. Their time, their work, their effort, you know, who actually is culpable if something goes wrong? And that gets me to like the usual joke of that I like, which is like decentralized finance means decentralized culpability. Meaning when some clusterfuck happens, like, no, you know, no one actually is to blame. It, you know, you just lose your money or you lose your NFTs or whatever. Like, that's a problem. Like, so we haven't solved much of that. And that's what the hardcore Bitcoin people keep saying, that, hey, guys, you haven't fixed this problem. Like, all you're doing when you have governance on chain is you're creating attack vectors that in the future you can't be sure aren't going to sink your project or sink your entire ecosystem. And that's a reasonable statement. Like, you could argue that you could have entire countries that make bad decisions, right, that lead to the complete loss of that country at some point. In fact, if you look at human history and you look at human civilization, how many civilizations still exist in their original form? Like, almost none, right? So, like, most kingdoms in most regimes have essentially fallen to one folly or the other, regardless of the type of government. In fact, if anything, like, death is the like certainty here almost. And I don't know that anything specific about blockchain governance or otherwise really fully solves this for me. Like, I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah, unfortunately, anything that lives is faced with that same. And right. And the one thing I read something recently about animals with shells tend to outlive most other animals, you know, studying turtles and they're slow. Obviously, they're slow metabolism.
That's an interesting kind of element too. Not just shells, but the heart rate of most larger vertebrates has a very strong correlation with survival, inversely correlated. So animals that have a much faster heart rate live less long compared to those with a much slower heart rate. And interestingly, that actually plays out within individuals within the species too. So if you look at people whose heart rates tend to run relatively on the slower side at rest, so for example, in humans, like closer to 60 to 70, again, without symptoms, obviously, that's just their normal heart rate. Those people, that has a correlation with living longer, which may not be causal necessarily, but it sort of is, because if you look at like beta blockers like metoprolol for the use of heart rate reduction for heart disease, that has been shown to reduce all-cause mortality in people with not only heart disease, but generally. So there is this kind of, and there's also the people that have syndromes like tachycardia syndromes, rapid heart rate syndromes, where their heart rate will run like 110, 120, like sinus tachycardia syndromes. And that actually can lead to heart failure and earlier death as well. So having a heart rate at rest that runs abnormally fast, even if it's not an abnormal rhythm, it's not like ventricular fibrillation, ventricular tachycardia, et cetera, mortality can actually be higher with those diseases. And so this is interesting, like whether it's metabolic, call it what you will, there's this interesting correlation with your heart rate and how long you survive. So it's like every time your heart beats, you're one beat closer to death, essentially. Shelled creatures like turtles, I mentioned earlier, like there are certain organisms that live considerably longer than others for whatever reason. And metabolism and some of these elements have a role to play. But even turtles die, right? It's not like we know of any turtles that live forever. So, biological organisms, like they evolve much slower if they don't reproduce and die much faster, because you can't pass on traits that benefit the organism. So slower metabolism and slower evolving creatures that live much longer have to rely upon the environment that they live in, whether it's the ocean, whether it's the atmosphere, to be unchanging, unyielding for much longer periods of time, or their amount of tolerance for fault as far as like temperature differences or like access to water or whatever is much, much wider, so they can live a much longer lifespan. And so there are trade-offs that those organisms, the DNA has made in order to have those organisms persist compared to other organisms. And it's all very super interesting, like how it all plays out. And you, like, dog breeders sort of like understand this at some level too, right? Like if you breed to a certain extent for certain traits, you may actually breed out other good traits that make a particular organism more survivable. Like inbreeding among humans, for example, creates a lot of expression of autosomal dominant style autosomal recessive style diseases. And typically mixed race children have way less autosomal recessive diseases because, you know, the odds of having those genes in those two parents because they're from different races entirely is much, much less. So like their genetic survivability from that perspective is different. So yeah, a lot of interesting like biological correlates that can be brought into like the crypto space. But I think there's not been enough study as far as like what DNA does for mutability and like how that can be translated to how we think about blockchain, NFTs, and this concept of permanence over the long run.
Question, if I may.
Sorry, go ahead.
Thank you, guys. Okay, my question is, I have a zero knowledge in crypto, and my question is it possible that we see crypto in the future to shift a proof of stake instead of proof of work? Is it possible?
Well, of course, you know, right now there's both proof of work and proof of stake happening. Proof of stake and proof of work essentially function very differently. Both examples, the concept is to create an immutable ledger, which is a series of data points that don't change over time, so that once I create a block, that block stays the same forever. Proof of work does this by basically replicating the entire chain over and over again on every single node or validator or proof of work mining machine. Proof of stake does this in a similar way, but with a combination of consensus that uses a validator network, but doesn't have to, like that validator doesn't have to do a workload where it replicates the chain over and over again. The tech is a bit different. There are kind of information and biological correlates of both examples. I think there will be certain types of tasks that will be, that make sense from a proof of work perspective, and certain tasks that probably will benefit from a proof of stake, or even the DAG kind of technology, or the decentralized graph type technology, which is a little bit different. So there's several different ways to basically put information in a database and have it persist over time. And that's really what we're talking about when we're talking about blockchain, is persistence and how to keep information going indefinitely, immutably, so that if I lay claim to a piece of code, that code is mine, or I can prove ownership, I can transmit it across the world using electronic means, and I can do so without you being able to falsify that information. The proof of systems, the biggest problem we have with them is centralization, in that, like, let's say I create a new blockchain today and I want to get a bunch of validators. So you guys are like, hey, I'll be validators for you. Okay, great. So you guys are going to end up with the first ability to become validators for this new chain, which automatically makes it centralized among the people that I know personally, right? Like, how would you advertise to the entire human race, hey, everybody on the planet can be a validator. In fact, every one of you already is one. And therefore, like, this chain is credibly decentralized because, like, everybody has some validation effect on this particular chain. There's no way to create that system, right? There's no way to create that in any rational way. Some of the networks that we have in the world are somewhat decentralized in the sense that, like, if you look at cell phone networks or the internet, the more people that use them, the more decentralized they become. On the other hand, you have examples of centralization there where, like, let's say Amazon Web Services might control a serious portion of the actual servers that these run on, or certain countries may control the governance and spying capabilities on those systems, et cetera. So, like, no matter what you do, you'll have trade-offs. Proof of stake, proof of work, centralized, decentralized. You have lots of ways to store information on a database that persists over a long period of time. And who gets to decide what information is on that, how long it persists, et cetera. Another example of this type of problem is, you know, if you go to the some of the Norwegian countries, I forget which one it is. I'm just in Norway, maybe. It could be Sweden. I can't remember. But there's a company that basically built a seed bank. What they did was they went deep in the earth where it's sufficiently consistent temperature. And they said, hey, we're going to store a lot of seeds that have not been genetically modified by various companies. You know, like, you've heard of Monsanto and others who have genetically modified seeds so that they can kind of, like, make them big ass dinosaur, you know, tomatoes and stuff. You guys go to the supermarket, you know what I'm talking about. You find that T-Rex sized chicken legs. That stuff didn't come naturally, right? There's like a lot of genetic modification, breeding, and you get these kinds of, like, agriculture. But the complaint is, well, if we have a lot of this stuff, well, eventually meteor strikes. We have all these stupid seeds that were super modified to only work with certain chemicals and only work in certain, you know, combinations. And if something bad happens, well, the average human being, we're not going to be able to start up the agriculture again. So a seed bank was created and they stuck it deep within the earth. They decided which seeds were going to go in there. Like, you know, I'm pretty sure I didn't submit any sperm to that, you know, seed bank or whatever. So I'm pretty sure they've already decided that I'm not worth saving if I, you know, if something happens or whatever, my DNA. But you see the thing, like, who chooses the information that goes in the seed bank, which seeds are deemed quote unquote worthy, that if something were to happen, we would reseed the planet with the stuff in the seed bank. Like, this is the kind of idea. Persistence over time is a really hard problem to solve in a blockchain, whether it's in any type of technology you can think of with blockchain or the internet or information, suffers from this problem of the amount of energy required to do this over very long periods of time. We talked about this when we first started, like, if I have a picture of my puppy and I want it to last for, you know, 50,000 years, what's the, like, energy least intensive way of doing this so that 5,000, 10,000 years from now, someone can take a look at my picture of my puppy and marvel in its amazingness. You know, do you decode that JPEG on a crystal and stick it in a cave on Earth so if a meteor strikes, someone can dig it up one day, some anthropologist or something? Notice, by the way, the more secure you make it, the harder it is to access it, right? So security, scalability, and speed, you know, the trilemma of blockchain or information in general, persists regardless of what type of information you're talking about. I could make it really, really, really secure by burying it deep within the earth or sticking it in a, you know, in a vat of gold, and, you know, like, but then now nobody can find my picture of my puppy that's buried.
Thank you for all these valuable information.
It's a complicated problem.
Yeah, okay. A final question. Is it true that the miners in the States are facing obstacles in mining, or no?
There's always obstacles. Like, right now in the state of Texas, there is a heat wave taking place, and the mining operations, miners have been asked to like stop mining in order to allow people to get their air conditioners to work. There's pros and cons. The more Bitcoin miners there are, the more driving force there is for electrical companies to build out their grid. So peak power consumption requires peak infrastructure, and peak infrastructure costs lots and lots of money. So technically speaking, in some ways, Bitcoin mining actually enhances the infrastructure over time, so long as they're able to cut down during peak, peak usage times. As long as the mining is still viable in terms of the total profitability, I think that's still okay. I think as long as Bitcoin is currently at its current price, like twice the cost to mine, you know, in the United States, like let's say a Bitcoin costs $10,000 to mine one, and currently the price of Bitcoin is $20,000, then I think you're in a reasonably safe zone where even if miners turn off their miners for a number of days, that and the heat wave passes, that we'll be okay. But it's just one example of where they face challenges regarding the use of the public-private electrical infrastructure, right? So the public gets upset if they can't turn their air conditioning on. It's one thing to say, well, your air conditioning, your electrical system crashed and it wasn't the fault of anybody. But if a lot of electricity goes to one feature, the public is going to get upset if they can't turn their AC on, right? So that's going to happen.
Hey, I just wanted to jump in here real quick. Here's an article from Crypto Slate. The Senate of Paraguay sent a bill to the president's for the president's approval to allow crypto miners to use excess energy and be exempt from value added tax. If the bill passes by the president, Paraguay might become the next target of the crypto mining companies. I didn't need to say that.
Yeah, that makes sense. You know, like the idea there is, okay, if you're going to incentivize miners coming in and to, again, this builds out the peak infrastructure capability, it also brings capital into the country that otherwise, you know, they may not have available. So if they have the energy reserves, right, but they don't have any customers for that energy, the Bitcoin miners become a perfect way to build that infrastructure and develop the economy of that country. But in order to do so, you'd have to have surplus electricity, obviously, to make it make sense.
Exactly.
Are they losing right now, the miners, with the current price?
The mining that's getting affected. One of the ways you can check this is look at the Bitcoin hash rate, H-A-S-H rate, R-A-T-E. So you can Google that and you'll find like graphs of how much actual Bitcoin processing is happening. It tends to drop off more and more the lower Bitcoin's price goes, obviously. What has happened in the industry as of late is some companies have borrowed money in order to finance the manufacture and of mining facilities, of setting up, you know, mining, setting up buildings, as buying Bitcoin miners and everything. And some of them paid the highest price for their mining equipment, for their ASICs. They paid high because the market was really hot, right? So when Bitcoin was running like $60,000 a coin, obviously the price of the mining gear also goes up during that time. Some of those companies bought the mining rigs too high, and they did so on borrowed money. And now if the price of the coin drops a substantial amount, they budgeted for paying the interest on their loans, and they budgeted for paying for the power requirements and everything else, employees, usual expenses, right? And if that falls below a certain level, then they may have to either sell their mining equipment to pay down their loans or face liquidation and other problems. So that's where problems happen on the downside. The companies that bought their mining equipment while Bitcoin was, say, for example, 10,000 or 6,000, and they paid rock bottom prices for it, they're probably doing fine. It's the ones that bought high. It's not just consumers that buy Bitcoin. Like if I bought it at $70,000 and now it's worth 20, I'm upset. It's also the miners who get affected if they buy too high. And they have to consider that in their mining operations, essentially.
So is it possible by the end of this year, okay, we see the consolidation in Bitcoin prices?
Oh, well, who really knows about where price action is going? What we do know is that like currently it costs something in the neighborhood of $10,000 to mine a Bitcoin. Does that mean that price is going to go down to mining cost again? There were many times I figured like the Bitcoin network and the concept of Bitcoin was matured enough that people would value the coin higher than the cost to mine. And I have been wrong numerous times in this regard. Like I felt like, maybe the population likes their Bitcoin sufficiently enough that they're going to hold, even if it's close to mining cost. But turns out that like Bitcoin has dropped below its cost to mine multiple times over the last several years, as you guys have noticed. Like, you know, it's dropped to, you know, 6K, 4K, right? Like during the pandemic dump in 2020. So there are times when it drops a lot more than you think it will, even though the cost of mine is, you know, around 10K. Will that number hold? I have no idea. So, you know, what do? I kind of, you know, if the price of BTC were to drop to those levels, I'll get some more. If it doesn't, so what? I'll just hold on to what I have. So a lot of people kind of dollar cost average it if they want to go that route. Nobody can predict for you exactly what's going to happen. It's pretty much impossible to predict. The short-term volatility can be extraordinarily high. You know, you might see, everyone's seen it, obviously, going from 70K Bitcoin to, you know, 17K or whatever. That's a pretty substantial dump. Now, at the same time, the Bitcoin network has survived all of that. It has just survived a substantial number of miners shutting down when a lot of miners left China. It's been pretty battle tested from that perspective. And I think the idea that it's going to zero anytime soon, most of those fears have largely been allayed. There was a concern when BTC dropped to like 4,000, you know, in 2020. It's like, holy hell, like, you know, are these Bitcoin miners going to survive? You know, is the network going to stay secure? And it stayed secure even at 4,000. So to me, that repeated battle testing, to me, tells me that it should actually carry a premium compared to the cost of mine, right? Because a lot of things carry a premium compared to the cost of the actual like stock or product itself. Like, for example, like let's say you have some Apple stock. Today, Apple stock, I think, has a price to earnings ratio something in the neighborhood of 20-1, which means that people value the company as a growth potential, and they add value to because they believe the company will grow over the next, let's say, 5 to 10 years, as opposed to if it had a price to earnings ratio of, let's say, 1-1, that would mean people value it as exactly at the amount that it's able to earn, and maybe even discounting things like their property or their assets or their brand name and other things, right? So Bitcoin has a brand name that has value. I think if you look at Bitcoin, how many people on the planet have heard of the name Bitcoin? It's pretty high. That brand value alone to me is probably worth, I don't know, $100. Like Apple's brand name is worth probably in the $200 to $300 billion range. It's not easy to develop a brand name in a sense that powerful and over that much time. So I think for me, BTC is undervalued for what it is as far as the size of the network, the amount of processing power that's involved. But, you know, the human race has not decided to value Bitcoin at, let's say, $100,000 or $1 million, right? It just has, you know, human beings haven't decided this. If you think about gold, like, okay, gold, let's say $10 trillion market cap. And if Bitcoin's market cap is half a trillion, how long did it take gold to reach a $10 trillion store of value market cap? Basically, all of human history, as far, you know, most of recorded human history, as far as we know, right? So, you know, is Bitcoin valued where it should be for a store of value? Maybe. You know, I think BTC, from what the network is capable of doing and the fact that you can do things with Bitcoin that you cannot do with gold. There are, by the way, things you can do with gold you can't do with Bitcoin, obviously. But from a transmissibility standpoint, I think BTC rationally should be worth somewhere in the $100,000 to $200,000 per coin range. But at that range, mining is very profitable. And you'll see a lot more mine emerge if the price goes to those levels. Now, at the same time, if the mining increases, yeah, the local inflation increases, but you also get a side effect, and that is that the network strength actually goes up with the more people that are mining. So it's kind of a double-edged sword. So when you see hash rate continue to rise, typically, historically, over the last history of Bitcoin, as long as the hash rate year after year continues to steadily rise, typically price follows, even if there's extreme short-term volatility. That's pretty normal. So does that answer any of your questions? I'm not sure if that covers anything.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Okay. Thank you for all these informations. Okay. God bless you, brother. And hopefully we will not test the zero level in PTT.
Yeah, hopefully thank not.
You. Thank you very much.
I mean, basically, it's like a trial by fire. The lower the number goes and hash rate is maintained and recovers, the stronger the network is going to be perceived to be, because more people feel like it's not killable, right? But if there's fear that, hey, if the price goes this amount, maybe the network won't maintain, then that prevents people from, you know, storing, you know, billions, if not trillions of dollars worth of capital value within the system, right? So people want to know that to a high degree of certainty, they can store value there. And so far, if you're a Switzerland or you're a Saudi Arabia, you are pretty sure that if you have your money in gold, that is probably not going to zero, even if it's not going anywhere in terms of upward price, you're probably pretty, you know, you're pretty sure it's not going to zero as far as some store of value function relative to everything else. So that store of value function continues to sort of like evolve for Bitcoin in the public's mind. And a lot of the wallet data, by the way, does clarify that number of people with greater than one Bitcoin in their wallet has increased. The number of total number of wallets has increased. The size of the smallest wallets in terms of amount of Bitcoin generally has increased. So even through the last several years with prices being high, the number of people that have been using the network has increased substantially. The interesting thing is, like, price is a meme. So what ends up happening is when prices of everything go up, you have many, many new users that show up. They show up, the price goes crazy, you have a bubble, then the bubble crashes again, and a lot of people get wrecked. They're like, oh my God, Bitcoin's stupid, I'm out of here. They stop buying, then you get a bear market, and then you have people continuing to like buy Bitcoin, eventually it goes back up again. So it's built to have recurrent bubbles. It's built this way through the halving mechanism. It's built this way as the rewards mechanism creates a programmatic inflation, which decreases over time. And essentially, if you believe in the math, that ultimately the you know, total count of coins is going to become more and more stagnant because it's going to be harder and harder to mine new ones, then, you know, like the model for inflation would imply that there is a floor price for how much power goes into or how much the cost of mining runs into it. So at some multiple above the cost to mine, which currently is, let's say, 10,000 for you know, simple math, right now we're only at a 2x sort of price to earnings ratio if this was a stock, right? So like it's basically highly undervalued. You know, that would be like, you know, Apple's share price right now being 1/25th of what it is. So many stocks are actually dramatically overvalued even now, even after the big stock market crash compared to Bitcoin. So like for me, like BTC at $20,000 to $10,000 price levels, for me, it's a safer investment than many, many stocks are even now, especially tech stocks, which still many of them have premiums of like 20-to-1 price to earnings ratios.
So, maybe people agree with me, okay, 2022 affected, okay, a lot of the market, okay, in general, affected negatively in the traders, you know, because a lot of, you know, coins dropped maybe more than 80% of the value.
Yeah, the altcoin market especially is going to be even more volatile than the Bitcoin market. And yeah, you're right. Like many things have dropped from 70% to 90%, if not. And you know, you might have some bear market recoveries of those. You might see them pop a little bit. You might see some sellers. Proof of stake networks, validators have to make money in order to keep the networks running. So there's always going to be people selling. It's only when the buyers outstrip the number of sellers that prices can eventually climb back up. What most of the contention generally is about is, hey, are we in a super cycle for adoption? Is adoption escalating in an exponential pace to where the bear markets are going to get shorter, right? So the super cycles usually is not that super cycles are stable and price just only goes up. It means that there's a very rapid cycling between ups and downs. So it would be like, for example, if BTC today is $20,000 and by the end of the year it's 100, well, then we're in a super cycle probably, because the speed with which the recoveries happen are not measured in years, but maybe in months. And, you know, that's, I think, something up for debate. Nobody really knows, though. Really, what you're going to watch for is metrics such as, are more and more people coming to crypto, or more and more people coming to Bitcoin? Are people using these things as store of value? Are they actually using them in their daily lives? And, you know, one of the things that really increased the game here a bit is the NFT market, because what NFTs need, you need to essentially create internet native products. So what are products that you can buy on the internet that you can't buy anywhere else, that you can't just 1.04? And are these products going to deliver value to people that they're going to love these things and want more of them? And I think if the more internet native products that get built, where people want to get on board with crypto, whether it's to play video games and metaverses, whether it's to just, you know, transact with their artwork, whatever it is, each of those things will create a new set of users and add more people that have wallets, that understand the experience, understand the value, and that's how super cycles are built, right? Like when we had our Nokia phones and our Motorola flip phones, I don't think many of us imagined in 2000. I don't think many of us imagined that we were going to be sitting here on Twitter Spaces chatting with each other a mere 20 years later, and you know, bullshitting about cryptocurrency that, you know, didn't even exist in 2000, right? Like, so you know, there's a variety of things that happened in that time frame that, in terms of tech progression, where we had a super cycle of the smartphone. We still are riding that super cycle for adoption, in that every person on the planet doesn't own one yet. And the same thing is sort of happening with crypto tech. What I'm not fully sure of, by the way, as far as like investment is concerned, is, let's say we have the next big revolution, which is basically machine learning, AI related expenditure. Is a lot of capital going to flow into that tech? Or is it going to continue to flow into, you know, crypto-related activity? We don't live in a vacuum. If a lot of cool shit comes into play, people might put their money into other things, and therefore, even if crypto and NFTs and everything are awesome, whether or not they attract the capital or not long term, that's an unknown, right? Like, look what happened in Nokia. I always give that example. Like, okay, Nokia was at the top of its game. I think it owned like 90% of the cell phone market back in, you know, before the dot-com bubble. And now nobody uses a Nokia phone anymore. And at the time, oh shit, Nokia is so powerful. How is it ever going to be supplanted? And then, of course, Apple comes along and, you know, iPhones get announced and the rest is history. But like, I don't think when in 2000, when you were using your Nokia phone, I don't think you imagined that Nokia would disappear into oblivion, pretty much, right? Like, that wasn't really what we thought. We figured Nokia would like innovate and they'd make cool shit just as usual, but they could not. So, you know, is it possible that things like Bitcoin, things like you know, the current major contract platforms that we think are so awesome turn out to be not as awesome as we think? That's certainly possible. Hero, what's up, bud?
I was just gonna say, Seth, if you can hear me.
Yeah, go ahead, bud.
I think you're pronouncing it wrong. I think it's Nokia, and then it's an iPhone for iPhone.
Yeah.
No, just a joke. No, I see your space. Just wanted to hop on, you know, share some good vibes. Could we serenade a little song there?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah?
We can swap to whatever you want to talk about.
Let me know if it.
Your connection's kind of breaking up, or I'm not sure it's me or you. You're better now.
Oh, it's better? Okay. All right, I'm going to give the beat first. If someone guesses, then we'll give them a price.
Sounds good. Go ahead.
Awesome. Awesome. So, did anyone guess the beat? It goes. Tum, 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 tum. Tum, tum, tum. No? Anyone?
If anyone knows the song, hop up and win whatever prize the guys have got for you.
Do you have it, Sefi? Does it ring any bells?
I don't know. You need to give me a few more bars on that one.
Tum 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 tum, and then it drops the beat. All right, here we go.
I don't think I know the track.
In West Philadelphia, born and raised on the playground where I spent most of my days, chilling out, maxing, relaxing out, cool, and chewing some ball outside of school.
Oh.
And I greet you guys. Yeah.
Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
Let's go. Finish it up for me. When a couple of guys, they were up to no good.
I don't remember the song, but I know the song. I don't remember the lyrics.
I got in one little fight and my mom got scared. She said, "You move in with your auntie and you're going to Bel Air." That's it, man. I just wanted to serenade you for a second. I know,
that was a great show, though, wasn't it?
But that's it, guys. Hello from here. We're just, about good vibes and you know.
Where's Hero going to be publishing? Where are you guys publishing NFTs in the future?
We have a small collection on Stargaze. We wanted to make some friends out there since, a lot of, the Terra community, disperses all over the place. And then after that, later, maybe a month after, so the Stargaze collection is in August, and it's going to be a pixelated Hero collection of tokens. So, it's just for fun. But then we have something cool on Polygon, and we'll see if we can sort of gamify some, maybe a little crafting game, since Polygon has, the tech, and then they're giving a lot of support for projects as well. So, that's just a little in the future alpha. That's all. Thank you.
Crafting, and you can modify the content of an NFT, or you can combine NFTs to create new NFTs.
Yeah, so maybe a little bit of a combination. So I'm working with the Osmosis team right now on helping them launch their NFTs, and they for example, they're doing a NFT that is, so everyone will be able to claim the art base layer, in this case of Wasmo, for example, and that's going to be available through the DEX. And so what they're doing is they're utilizing, so John, who is the lead on the NFT for Osmosis, he is the co-founder of Treasure DAO, or he's the founder of Treasure DAO, and then he co-founded a small collection there too. But he's saying that Cosmos blockchain really is the one to plant the gamification, because of it's interchain and pretty much super low fees. So I don't know where that hits you, Dane, is the cost perfect for gaming. So they're doing a little bit of a crafting where you combine certain tokens together. If you guys want to follow them, it's Osmosis NFTs. But they're doing a little bit of crafting where you can, item together, and then you unlock other items by, let's say you're locked in on some pools because the NFTs are essentially attached to the DEX. So the more you use the DEX, you can unlock certain accessories and stuff like that. So I'm getting ideas from there, and I'm like, the whole crafting deal, if you get to unlock accessories and different, pretty much accessories, these are in the sense of the token. And it just gave me ideas for the Hero community, because they're kind of legions, they're apes. So I'm like, crafting.
Yeah. Super cool. The crafting scene is kind of popular, obviously, among certain MMOs. EQ, World of Warcraft, and a lot of other early RuneScape, and a lot of Ultima Online, a lot of games kind of brought that into the foray with selling crafted parts and things. They tended to be more interesting when you could use those crafted parts as part of a greater experience. And I think the sort of like NFT game experience in terms of what's going to take off, what's going to be really popular, I think is still in its infancy in that regard. My suspicion with NFT crafting and games, I used to love playing that stuff. And I think my suspicion, just from having played a lot of it and what I like, is that the future games that probably are going to be really, really popular with these kinds of features really don't even exist yet. And not only that, but the game experience itself, I think, is going to evolve in such a way that, like, some of the most interesting versions are going to be like one of those things that 10 years from now, you're like, hey, I wish I thought of that. You know, in other words, people hadn't really fully, like, played out how that's going to impact all of this. And some of the platforms like Stargaze, Kadena is doing this with Marmalade, with their NFT platform. The programmability of NFTs is becoming more and more interesting as far as like metadata that could be potentially modified so that your NFT is like, you know, not fungible, but it's not fully immutable either. So it's like a database where, you know, things can change. You can like breed animals, or, you know, you can do like, it's like DNA. It basically can be modified over time. And that's an interesting like direction the industry is going.
I'd be stoked to get you on a space with these guys, with John, sometimes Sunny, Osmosis, CEO hops on it too. And then Chango on, you know, on station, because they do have, like, for example, they're trying to create a loop for, you know, for users to kind of like stay in the game. But then there's kind of like a question, and let me actually shoot it to you just to see what your take on it is. So the game designer was worse. Give me 1 second.
Basically, the real question is, what are the features of a game that make it really, really addicting and has replay value, right? The ultimate, like, question people ask, like, what's the next chess, for example, and how do we monetize the moves of chess? Or, like, what's the next, you know, whatever. Like, even the big MMOs, by the way, the EverQuest, RuneScapes, all those, you know, types of long-term games, World of Warcraft, many of those have evolved over time, have new users, have really old users that love it. So there are definitely communities in each of those ecosystems that never left, like really hardcore old school people. Even the game over and over again, they love it. Like, people like to play Skyrim over and over again. You know, a lot of those type of things. And then, like, whether or not that is the basis for like a persistent long-term community of people that are going to bring value to NFTs in that space, that's the tough part. The hard part to me is making the great game. The hard part is not necessarily making like a JPEG of something, or even for that matter, making like a weapon in a video game or whatever. Anyone can make those things. What is the hard part is making those things have some kind of persistent value long term is really the hard part. And I don't know that any game system has, even some of the old school gaming systems haven't really worked that out. I think that's why Steam and some of the other big companies haven't pushed into crypto, because they've done gaming long enough to realize that, like, there is kind of a transientness to video games and gaming, and that, you know, many games don't ultimately achieve persistence. Examples of some that have would be like Pokemon's done pretty good. Like, how many guys think that Pokemon's still going to be a thing 500 years from now? I don't know. I'm not really sure. But it's made it a really long way, right? Like, it's done amazingly. Yeah. It's done way more than I would have thought when, you know, when the kids in my, you know, school were playing Pokemon and stuff. I was like, what is with these little nerds? Like, I'm a nerd and I play, like, you know, MMOs and stuff. But card game nerds, like, a different level of uber nerd, right? Like, at least the ones on the video. But the Magic the Gathering crowd, the Pokemon crowd has certainly ceased to, I mean, like, they haven't ceased to amaze me in how much more persistent their communities have been than some of the video game communities, which is really interesting.
Yeah, you're definitely touching on a lot of points that, so his name is John Patton. That's like the CEO of Treasure DAO. It's a marketplace. And I definitely got to get you in a combo with him. Those are definitely touching on points where I'd love to hear you guys' conversation, Seffy. So I'll let you know.
Yeah, let's do something. That'd be fun.
Yeah, here, last thing. I'll save the question for this upcoming call. I'll do that. But anyway, I'll let you go. I was coming in here real fast. Thanks again. Have a good day.
Yeah, well, hope everyone had a good time. I think I'm going to break anyway. I've got some things to do, so we'll catch up another time. It's kind of one of these impromptu thing hangouts, so certainly people have some interesting combos going on. Want to shoot me a DM or invite, I'll be happy to jump onto people's things. It's a lot of fun hanging out with these things and talking tech and crypto and shit. All right, yeah, everyone have a good day. We'll catch up later.
Thanks for checking out another episode of The Ether. That was a CeFi Space Share Your Crypto Alpha, recorded on Sunday, July 17th, 2022. For TerraSpaces.org, I'm Finn. Thanks for listening.
They say rapping is the gateway, bringing home great pay. Checking that replay, sing along and we say nobody gives a fuck around my way. I make about $3 for every 1,000 plays, so add it up and do the math on that. Financially speaking, why the fuck would anybody wanna rap? But in this reality, the money comes from doing shows. But then where's the money go when you can't do the shows? I guess you could rap on Cameo. I've been asking all my friends if I can rap on the patio. 6 feet, motherfucker, step the fuck back. Doing a little magic, pulling rabbits out the rucksack. Not everybody's always in it for the money. Looking like another crooked Sunday and I'm working Monday. So you know I ain't stressing, left debating great methods. Amazed to play Inception, the bass stay blessed.
See, even with these huge sums of overall royalties, the sums of money that go to the record label per playback can seem insultingly small. Many rights holders are making around three quarters of a cent each time to one of their tracks, leaving only some portion of that for the actual artist. Pennies per play. Until they can figure out how to turn a profit, their future will always be in question. But for now, investors see enough potential to continue to fund pennies per play.
Another day, another lesson. Living in the eighth dimension might be worth a little mention. Living in the Great Depression, got a real regal feel. Reeling in another sucker fish out to make a deal, just to make a motherfucker wish. Aw shit, now you only got two left. You know what I wish? We didn't have any loose ends. You know what I miss? Listening to excuses. Now we're on the fence like we forgot how to choose. That's what happens when people don't know what's true. In the dark, eating bullshit up like a mushroom. In the lunchroom, just trying to laugh it off. Meanwhile, foaming at the mouth like a rabid dog. Like a fake mating call at the zoo. It's looking like the view is getting disappointed too. I'm working on the new shit, trying to produce it. It's what I'm willing to go through when I'm making my music.
Spaces.